Introducing the new Starbucks Pistachio Cream Cold Brew. Silky pistachio cream cold foam tops our bold, smooth cold brew for a delicious twist on a favorite winter flavor. Make today a good day. Order ahead on the Starbucks app.
92% of households that start the year with Peloton are still active a year later.
92% because of a bike?
Not just bikes. We also make treadmills and rowers.
Oh, let me guess, for elite athletes only, right?
Nope. It doesn't matter if you're an avid exerciser or new to working out. Peloton can help you achieve your fitness goals. 92% stick with it. So can you. Try Peloton bikes, tread, or row risk-free with a 30-day home trial. New members only. Not available in remote locations. See additional terms at onepeloton.com/home-trial.
This is Neil Preston, and you're listening to Pantheon Podcasts.
Hey everyone, today my guest is Peter Bernstein. He's composed, orchestrated, and conducted some of the most well-known movies of our time. Ghostbusters and Trading Places are a couple. But there are also other incredible pieces of work like 21 Jump Street and Michael Jackson's Thriller. So we discuss his work in today's episode, but we also talk about his time as a bass player in LA. As a young musician in the late 60s and early 70s, he was part of that famous Laurel Canyon and Hoot Night troubadour scene. So he has an interesting perspective on that notable time and many stories to share. So let's get started. Peter, thank you for coming on today.
You're very welcome.
You have had a storied life, so I'm looking forward to diving into it today. So for all who are listening, and you correct me if I'm leaving anything out.
Okay.
But you are a conductor, an orchestrator, a composer, and a musician. Did I leave anything out?
Well, I started out life as a rock and roll bass player.
I know you did. And a bassist. And so much has come from it. But before we even go there, your past works, which include TV, music videos, movies. I mean, your credits include some of the, well, first of all, some of the greatest movies of all time. Because I'm a big 80s fan. So in terms of movies that you did at that time, Animal House, which I think was 1979, but then there's...
As an orchestrator.
But you were part of these incredible movie moments.
I was.
Ghostbusters, Stripes, Bill Murray's the best, Trading Places. And then since then, you know, Wild Wild West, Blues Brothers 2000. You did Ghostbusters Afterlife recently. You had your hand in quite a bit. Plus, I mean, Michael Jackson's Thriller video? Come on!
You know, it's funny about that because at the time, and it's only, I think there's 7 minutes of score in it, right? And that came and went in a couple of days, really. And, you know, my father called me, said, I'm going to do this. Please orchestrate it. I said, okay. And, you know, the next day I got this stuff and then I did my thing. And 2 days later, we're in the studio for 4 hours and that was it. And whoever, you know, no one ever thinks, oh yeah, this is going to be interesting. What is it? 40 years later, whatever it is now.
Yeah.
You don't think about that. As a matter of fact, I just about a year ago found my original pages from it, which have been moldering in a box.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. It went by in, you know, 3 days. Said hi to Michael Jackson in the studio.
So I was going to ask, any interactions with Michael?
Yeah. Well, the director of the video, John Landis, mm-hmm. is a lifelong friend of mine. I mean, we met in high school, junior high school.
Wow.
Maybe he was just a geeky kid who liked movies, you know.
Yeah. You're right, though. It's like a day in the life and you don't even think anything of it, how it's going to, the legacy of it, how it's going to affect people decades and decades, you know, down the road.
Mostly because you're too busy trying to get it done. I mean, nobody thinks about that, you know.
You're not in the middle of the project, like reveling in it, going, this is going to be phenomenal.
Well, no, but there have been times when, you know, when I go, well, this is interesting, you know, to be doing this. But usually, I mean, Ghostbusters, for instance, was a very tight schedule, and they were mixing the film down the hall. So every time we recorded a piece, the music editor would snip it out, I mean, of the reel, because it was all tape in those days, snip it out of the reel and run it down, you know, to the mixing room as fast as she could go. So, you know, it was very much like that. And it was very tense. And there were, how shall I say this, differences of opinion.
Very diplomatic, yeah. To hear those notes, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sing it. But it takes me back. I remember it because I remember seeing the commercials on TV, advertising it. And I was maybe a little young to go see it, but at the same time, it had an impact on me. And I remember people talking about it, the cool kids at school or whatever it was. There isn't, I don't feel like there's that, there isn't that impact these days at all. So, you know, it's incredible for you to be on the ground floor of such amazing pieces of work.
Hey, Mr. Tambourine Man, play a song for me. In the jingle jangle morning, I come following you.
Well, I can only imagine what it was like back then. Things have changed a lot, but I actually want to go farther back. You know, you mentioned your dad, who is, you know, the Academy Award winning film composer, Elmer Bernstein. And I guess I want to ask you, is he the one that really fostered this love of music? Gotta be.
Well, I, you know, it's an interesting question. There was certainly music in the house when I grew up, where I grew up. My mother was also a piano teacher for a time. And so there was music all around. But, you know, what happened to me was when I was 13, I became aware of the Beatles, who were just starting, and Bob Dylan, who was just becoming electrified. Yeah. And it melted my 13-year-old brain. So
you and every other music-loving teenager at that time.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what I was, you know, that's what happened to me. It had nothing to do with what my father did, although it was cool and, you know, things like that. But what really got me excited was that other music. There was a band in my very small junior high school. I mean, my, you know, the classes had like 30 or 40 people in them in Oakwood in Los Angeles.
Okay.
And some friends of mine had started a band, which for some reason I wasn't in. And they had a guy playing bass, kind of, who clearly had no idea what he was doing. And I looked at him and went, oh, yeah, I can do that. So I did. That's how I ended up there.
And that really, I guess, planted the seed, huh? In terms of you thinking, this is something I might want to do.
I wasn't so much what I want to do as what I was. Mm. You know, if somebody said, what are you? I would have said, oh, rock and roll baseball.
No, you weren't in some little, you know, Midwest town where, you know, there wasn't, maybe that dream wasn't something that, you know, kids would ever think that they'd realize. You were in Los Angeles.
Well, it's not so much of a dream as what you think is normal. I was in school with the children of a number of, you know, very top end Hollywood composer.
Wow.
So, of course, someone's father was nominated for an Academy Award every year. You know. Didn't that happen everywhere?
No.
Yeah, well, apparently not. But I didn't know that until I was much older.
Sure. That was your reality.
I mean, seriously, I was at the end of my teens when the horrible realization that most people get up early and go to work all day hit me. I mean, I just had no frame of reference.
It's awful, isn't it? Well, then what was Los Angeles like when, you know, I would say, what is it, late 60s or so, being a musician, being out there, what was the scene like for you?
Well, I will say that compared with today, it was a lot easier.
Yeah.
There was a lot of mixing. of course, there were no cell phones, there was no internet. So everything was done in person at whatever venues or rehearsals or hangouts you were at. So that was very different. There was a different kind of community. Mm-hmm. And the other thing that you could do in the late 60s and early 70s is survive by playing in local clubs, which I did for a time. Now that's, you know, that's out of the question. But then, you know, we'd play a few nights here and a few nights there, and it was just enough money to scrape by and keep working on our music, do a recording here or there.
Don't even try to understand. Just find a place to make your stand. You take it easy.
You know, also in the circle, in the same circles in Los Angeles, 1970, where Glenn Frey and Don Henley, who had just come from Texas, mm-hmm. Linda Ronstadt, who had come from
Arizona,
Tucson, yeah, and Jackson Brown, who would, I guess would be the most well-known. And, you know, Linda had had her singles with the Stone Ponies.
Mm-hmm.
But she wasn't, you know, she was kind of struggling, you know, putting out a record now. And then there was also one of the other members of the Stone Ponies, Kenny Edwards, who I was in various bands with in those days. And my original music friend, Andrew Gold, mm-hmm. who had a number of hits in the 70s and had a lot to do with Linda's success.
Mm-hmm.
Who else? Wendy Waldman, Carla Bonoff, both not as well known, but have written a lot of songs that a lot of people have heard. And really, when you think about it, it was only for about 10 years or so.
I know.
But 10 years at that point was my entire adult life. So
right.
It felt like my whole life.
So were you part of that troubadour crowd?
Oh, yeah, definitely. So
it was Monday night, Hootenanny nights?
Yeah, I did a few.
Tell me about that. I mean, this is like such a place and time. And to me, there's just so much magic around it. Now, I know that those Hootenanny nights were kind of a scene, CB scene type thing.
Yeah, it was a total scene. You never knew who would show up. And, you know, it was always our manager or whoever was shepherding the band would say, yeah, got us a slot at the Troop tonight. And so we'd all trundle down there and, you know, get up on stage and play for half an hour. You saw a lot of interesting stuff at Hootenanny. But it was fun and it was a hang. And, you know, you were there from 8 till 2 or whatever the hours were.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was a total scene. And all the people I've just mentioned played there.
Mm-hmm. And this was your scene then. You were hanging with these people as they were all up and coming as well, going to their places in Laurel Canyon.
Some had come up further than others, but yes.
Yeah. And as that was happening and you're hanging out with these people and you're all, you know, yeah, some are a little higher than others, but for the most part, at least all started on the same footing. Are you conscious of the fact that these guys are getting so big?
Well, yes and no. I mean, yeah, that was cool. But on the other hand, you know, hanging out. And
yeah.
And some of these, you know, even post their giant successes, it was still, let's hang. You know, there it was, that part of it didn't change very much, except, you know, maybe with Linda, it was harder to go out in public sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
She was so recognizable. But, you know, it people generally wore it pretty well.
Hey guys, we're going to take a quick break to hear a word from our sponsor. And we're back. So from that time, from that magical era that you were, hanging out in L.A. and having those Hootenanny nights, any great memories from some of those guys? the Eagles or Ronstadt or Jackson, whoever it might be?
Well, mostly those memories are from my bands doing or from my friends, close friends' bands. I remember seeing Linda when the Eagles were still backing her up. But that was at some like weird club fundraiser thing in Beverly Hills. One of my favorite moments with Linda was my then wife and her and Jerry Brown, when she was going out with Jerry Brown, decided we'd go out to dinner. Oh. So we drive out to Musso Frank's in Hollywood. I think Linda had just been on the cover of Time magazine or, you know, whatever it was. I mean, she was, you know, the number one female singer in the rock and roll world in those days. There really wasn't anybody else in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
And so we walk into Musso Frank's, which was full, and everybody stopped talking. It was, you know, and this is in Hollywood, right? You know, people are used to that kind of stuff, but it was pretty amazing and pretty weird too.
Sure, to be with that. But you got to think, Linda and then Governor Jerry Brown. I mean, that is quite a pairing.
Yeah, we did see a lot of them in those days.
From someone like me that's looking in, I see this shift in the music industry happening from the 60s to 70s. It becomes more, you know, more of a business rather than kind of this communal, like, hey, man, we're in it for the art. You know, at this point, it's about making money. And I don't know if, you know, Geffen was really the one that like put the accelerator on that. But
you know, the record companies were always about making money.
Sure.
It's just the way it looked became different, you know, and the way they developed artists became different. You know, there used to be a great deal of artist development. So, oh yeah, your first album flopped, but a couple more, you'll get it. You know, mm-hmm. that I don't think that's happening. Well, that stopped happening a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, you know, well, a case in point, Randy Newman.
Yeah.
He made a number of records that didn't do much of anything. Or Ry Cooter, who barely made any records that did anything anyway, but he was such an obvious talent that why would you drop him, you know?
Right.
I could say the same thing for James Taylor. These are all Warner Brother acts, by the way, who, you know, had a few hits and then not so much for a long time. Mm-hmm. But they let him keep making records.
And it, for you, how long were you in it before you decided you wanted to do something different?
Well, I was a special case. I was always curious about other things. Growing up as I did, I was aware of this whole other musical world out there.
Mm-hmm.
That amongst my friends, only Andrew Gold would have been, because his father was a composer as well. And his mother was a singer. So I was always aware of that. I was aware that there was a lot more to know than, you know, a few blues chords.
Yeah.
And so I never really was not in some sort of learning environment, whether it was school or private. About 73 or 4, I got curious about orchestrating. And I went to my father and I said, you know, I think I'd like to learn how to do this. I'd learned it in school. I knew the ranges of the instruments, but that doesn't tell you very much. So he said to me, well, fine, go orchestrate something. Bring it to me. So I took a piece of piano music that I had been practicing. And I did that and I brought it to him and he looked at it. And I assume... at least I got an A for effort. I don't know. I don't have the paper anymore. It might have been horrific, but it was enough for him to guide me a little bit. And a year later, or a few months later, I was doing little bits on some of his films. And a couple of years later, this is, we're in the late 70s now, I was the sole orchestrator on Stripes, for instance. And well, at the same time, I was doing my rock and roll thing. I produced a number of records in those days. In fact, some years ago, just by accident, I came across my date book from 1984. I don't know why I wasn't like tired. But I looked at it, there's a lot going on.
Now, if the bass player role had taken off by some chance, would you have stuck with it?
Depends on the context. I mean, there is a purity to being nothing but an instrumentalist, you know, just being able to play. But I've had a number of moments in my career where I'm trying to learn to do something and I'm being taught by someone who is very, very good at it. And I think, oh, you mean I have to be that good? No, not for me.
And that dedicated. And you say that, and I don't know if you're referring to Carole Kay.
No, I'm not. Crew. No. Actually, what Carole did was very accessible to me. Yes, I took lessons from Carole Kay for a couple of years. She was great. I didn't.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of these, when I was a bass player doing sessions for films or television, I was playing next to these incredible people, which of course I didn't appreciate at all. Wrecking Crew people. I thought Tommy Tedesco was cool, but
no Earl perspective Palmer, yet. Yeah.
Or Earl Palmer or people like that, but I didn't have the perspective. I mean, I was, you know, barely 20. And Carole was, you know, probably 20 years older than me. And she had a very soft Southern accent, like from the DC area, like you'd hear. And she would say, okay, now we're going to play a little boogaloo. And so that was my lesson with Carole. I didn't play her style at all. So it was really very expanding to take those lessons with her.
How did that even come about? How did you even get the opportunity to take those?
Oh, through my lessons. Father.
Just he through your father?
Because he played dates with her, but I wasn't her only student at all.
Sure. Okay. She had many.
Oh, no. We'd go, there'd be like four people at a time in her house, all with our bass guitars and, you know, playing whatever it was. I did learn some really good stuff from her, though.
And when you decided to finally move on and, you know, stop, for your own sanity, I'm sure, stop playing bass, I mean, was there some, you know, regrets? Do you miss it? Did you miss it?
Oh.
I know you're back at it. But
I still play, but I'm the only person foolish enough to pay myself to play for them. No, if you know what, if somebody says, if I say I'm a musician and somebody says, oh, what's your instrument? You know, or what do? The very first reaction, it's primal, right? I'm a bass player. And then I have to go, I edit that and go, well, I do a lot of things.
Mm-hmm. But primarily a bass player.
Well, you know, it's what you did when you were, I mean, I was a child, right? I was 14. So with attitude, I might add. And but that's the primal reaction.
I'm sure. And you know, it's funny because I've talked to a lot of guests about this, that seminal moment in 1964. When most of them decided that they wanted to be a musician, you know, maybe.
And who were they hearing?
They were hearing the Beatles. They were all hearing the Beatles. And I remember even, you know, when I had Henry Diltz on, he said, you know, he was with the Modern Quartet at the time, and they were touring, and they were watching them on Ed Sullivan. And Henry says, I mean, we're looking at each other and going, well, what the hell are we singing about the ox driver for? We got to play some rock and roll.
Well, I also had a strong folk background at the same time. My parents, being old New York lefties, were very into the folk music of the time, mm-hmm. which was, Pete Seeger, the Weavers, all those proto folk people. So that was in the mix as well. And I listened to those as a child. They were played for me by my parents. But, you know, with the Beatles, it wasn't so much the rush of seeing them for the first time, just as you're becoming an adolescent. You know, it was just perfect timing for me. But it was the journey as well. And the journey of the Beatles from 1963 to 1967, when they became some other band entirely. And that was my, you know, 13 to 17.
Formative.
When I became someone else entirely. That was a journey, right?
Yeah.
And along with that journey, there was also Bob Dylan, who was, you know, inventing a whole other kind of popular music.
Right. Right. And rock itself was just coming on the scene. I mean, so you get rock, you get folk rock together, but then you have all these British invasion bands that are coming in, right. And they're creating their own sound. And there was just nothing like it if you're going to compare it to the rock of the 50s and whatnot.
Well, there was folk rock, and the other band that was folk. Really into was the Byrds.
Oh, of course. Of course.
And, you know, my friend Andrew Gold, you know, by the time we were 15, he was doing Jim McGuinn spotlessly. I mean, it was kind of amazing, actually. And we all struggled to keep up.
You know, it's interesting to me back then, these bands that were so popular, like the Byrds, had such a short shelf life. And maybe I shouldn't say shelf life, but just their career. The Byrds were together, at least, you know, the classic version that included Crosby was probably two, three years.
But that was their whole adult life too, at that point, you know?
Buffalo Springfield. I mean, and these were huge, huge bands. So you want to be a rock and roll star, then listen now to what I say. Just get an electric guitar and take some time and learn how to play.
What I should touch on that we didn't was seeing all these people in the 60s at the Whiskey.
Please do.
The Hullabaloo and the Byrds, the Buffalo Springfield, Iron Butterfly, who were everywhere.
Were there one hit in Agata Di Vita?
They were very popular on the Strip. What can I tell you? What was the other band? Oh, the split off from Iron Butterfly, Rhinoceros. Who else? I saw Cream there. I saw Cream in England in 1967 as well, coincidentally. I was in London in the summer of 67. I was sent to have an educational experience,
I'm sure.
at a dormitory, and I got an education, all right.
Yeah, that's a relative term.
I know. I learned how to do all the fun stuff. But we also went to the Windsor Jazz Festival, which was no longer a jazz festival in those days. And it was Cream and Arthur Brown and 10 Years After. And I don't know if Ainsley Dunbar rings a bell with you, but it was a lot of, you know, British bands of that era.
So what was it like walking into, say, the Whiskey to see the Byrds play at that time?
You know, even that felt special. It did, because they were very special to me. Oh, Big Brother. Saw Big Brother there.
Big Brother in the Holding Company?
Yeah.
With Janis?
Yeah. I mean, you know, we were young, right? So it would be like this. There'd be a battle of the bands at the Hullabaloo, I think it was called. And then later it became the Aquarius Theater and then the Nickelodeon Theater.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And previously it had been the Moulin Rouge, you know, in a dinner club in Los Angeles. And it was, none of us could drive. So it was like somebody's parent or housekeeper who would drive us back in this. No, seriously, would drive us in the station wagon. We'd load our stuff out, do our battle of the bands. You know, hey, mom, can you pick me up?
And that was it.
That's how it, well, I mean, we couldn't hitch. Not with the amp.
That's too funny. Yeah, she, you know, I had also too Pamela DeBar as well on the show.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, she's an LA girl as well. And she grew up in the Valley, and she would talk about getting rides to the Sunset Strip from like a parent or whoever it is. And just
you had to get there. Oddly, I missed the riot. I wasn't there that day or that night, whatever it was. However, I went to the benefit concert they had out in the San Fernando Valley a few days later at the Molesta Theater that's no longer exists. And that lineup was the Byrds and Kumasi Kala, oddly, and the Mothers and the Doors. Oh, yeah, the Doors. You used to see the Doors around back in those days.
You'd see the Doors around, you'd see them play, or you'd see Jim stumbling around Sunset Boulevard?
I'd see him stumbling around on stage. Oh,
but back then, I would say probably on the Sunset Strip, they said there was probably somewhere within that 1.7 stretch, 25 plus clubs for kids to go to and play out, say, circa 68, 69.
I can think of, well, Gazzari's, which is long gone. I played in Gazzari's. I played in the Whiskey. I played in the Roxy. I don't know. I was done before Viper Room showed up.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, during the New Wave era, of, you know, 1980, 70, 78, 79, 80, 81, there was another explosion of clubs in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Many, many places where we all played Wong's, Madame Wong's West. My best friend was the booker there. I mean, my current best friend was the booker there.
Oh, my gosh.
And you know, there are all these places. I can't remember half of their names anymore. But there was an explosion of venues you could, you know, you could go play at.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, and that scene, I mean, LA again became the epicenter of music and what every other band was emulated from about 81, 82, like when Motley Crue hit the scene and some of these other, you know, heavy metal bands or hair bands, as you want to call them, which I know they don't like to be called, but everything was changing. And I feel like that was another, and I'll use this word again, a very magical time. You know, the Strip was the place to be. It was where you went to find a record deal. And they tell these stories. Who was I talking to? A friend of mine runs tours on the Sunset Strip. And he said the record labels sometimes would have offices right across the street from, say, the Rainbow or the Roxy, because, or even the Whiskey, because you get these kids that just played a set. They might be drunk off their minds and a little bit more susceptible to maybe inking a deal.
I lastly, oh yeah, well, occasionally, but one of the famous stories is Van Halen being signed by their producer Teddy Templeman, but being signed by Teddy Templeman when he went to the Whiskey and saw the line around the block. Went, oh yeah, they're signed. That was the story. In the middle 80s, a few things happened. I'd been composing, and I got a job doing a movie called The Ewok Adventure for Lucasfilm. And that was a big deal at the time. I also did its sequel. It was a TV broadcast, but it
I
was
remember it.
Yeah, it was a very big deal. I was the first guy not named John Williams to do something. Now it's like the black sheep of the Star Wars family. But at the time, it felt like a big deal. And there was a connection there, too, because Linda Ronstadt was dating George Lucas at the time. So
I don't think I knew that. Wow.
Yeah. So she was around. And then a couple of years after that, or not even, one of my rock and roll mates was now a associate producer, I think, on a show that was about to be made called 21 Jump Street.
And I think I've heard of it.
He introduced the producer. And so I ended up doing that job. So that was a really fruitful couple of years that really, you know, had a big impact in my career going forward.
I mean, like I said, your list of credits are just incredible. You know, these, I wouldn't say it's the same situation now with streaming and all of that and so many outlets to receive entertainment. But back then, seeing a movie could be life-changing.
It was just a much smaller set of things to choose from.
And you went and saw that latest movie. And if it was a great movie, it affected everybody.
In 1984, I orchestrated Ghostbusters and also wrote the score for the Ewok Adventure. So that was a seminal year for me.
Well, speaking of today, though, what is it that you're doing right now? What's coming up for you? What have you just finished? I mean, I know you did Ghostbusters Afterlife. That was 2020. I feel like the world stopped in 2020 and there's just been nothing.
Well, I took an orchestration job. I mean, Ghostbusters Afterlife, I was kind of a score consultant, whatever that means, which was me giving my opinion on whatever people were asking me that related to the earlier film. And, you know, looking over the orchestrations and the score and suggesting this and that. I just a few months ago finished an orchestration job with the same composer for a film called The Adam Project. It's out now.
Yeah, with Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah. Orchestrated that. And then I've started composing with my sister, which is really fun.
Really? So she was in the music business as well.
Yes. She's about 20 years younger than me. Half sister, and but we share a father, and she had the job orchestrating for him a few years after I left. So she has somewhat of the same background. It's really fun because it's a point of view that I don't have, and it's always interesting and it's fun to do this family thing. I should add that. In 2013, believe it was, I was invited to a film music festival in Spain, where they were doing a bunch of my father's works and what I care to conduct. Now, conducting was something you learned to do as a matter of course when I was learning to be a composer, because you had to. I didn't use it much. Once computers came along. But that led to a second career as a conductor, which has been going since then. So since for the last few years, I've done, I don't know how many concerts of Ghostbusters, the original Ghostbusters, with the score performed live. So
how cool is that?
That's been fun.
Did you do this at the Hollywood Bowl?
No.
Okay.
I did not do it at the Hollywood Bowl. A couple of years ago, I did The Great Escape, same thing.
What a movie.
And so, yeah, those are really fun. Conducting is really fun. It's very low pressure. Occasionally, they'll call you maestro, which is not bad.
Yeah. And that's a great title.
I would never mistake myself for a great conductor, but I do know how to make it happen. So it's been a really nice thing to do at this stage of my career. I think, you know, and Ghostbusters every Halloween, right? There's
it's the movie.
I think there are, when I last checked, I think there were 10 performances booked in October.
Incredible.
Yeah.
So anything you haven't done that you still want to do?
In music?
Any. I would assume music, but maybe not.
Yeah, I'd like to play bass again. Like I said, there is a certain purity there that, which I also describe as immediacy, right? It's right there. It's happening now. It's never going to happen that way again. Composing is not like that. Nothing is like, you know, playing in that way. So I doubt an opportunity will arise, but if it did, I would do it.
Look at your life.
Good point. Conducting is close. You know, I mean, it is back to my roots as a performer of doing something live.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just playing bass. It's being out there. It's playing live to an audience, feeling that energy.
Well, you know, conducting Ghostbusters is kind of unique because I'm looking at the screen ahead of me and the audience is laughing and hooting and hollering behind me. It's not the usual deportment at a orchestra concert. So that's really fun.
I'm sure. But when you're playing bass and you're standing there looking at the audience, receiving the music that you're playing, there's probably nothing like that feeling.
No, there isn't.
I have a feeling a year from now, you're going to be saying, I'm back out on the road.
When I was in my last band, and before we got our deal and things got complicated, and, you know, you get a bunch of guys in their 20s in a room together, a little too much free-floating testosterone sometimes, you know. But when we were just developing our scene, and that, you know, we knew we were good and we could see the effect on the crowd and we could get up there and perform without wondering if we knew we were good. That was pretty unique. I have not really had that feeling since.
Yeah.
I have to say it's different now because in the late 70s, you know, it was still coming out of the punk era. And my band was, you know, the people thought, are they punk? Are they new wave? What's going on here? So we got a really mixed audience. And nowadays, people just want to get off. Then it was a different scene. You know, it was somewhat confrontational. It was the audience saying, all right, show us what you got.
Wow.
That was right after that phase I described where we knew we were good and it was all cool. After that, it turned into something a little different. But the scene was different. You know, there was a big rebellion in music. The punk scene was a big rebellion against what had been before.
Yeah.
New wave was a little different. That was just more fun.
Mm-hmm.
But it was somewhat confusing. I mean, the mega bands were there, and it didn't affect them at all.
Yeah, but what was happening below them? Yeah, there was a lot of transition.
The record companies were trying to figure it out, mostly unsuccessfully.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of new wave bands, so-called new wave bands, got signed in Los Angeles, and almost none of them broke through. I mean, there are a couple of enduring hits, My Sharona. That's What I Like About You, you know, enduring hits from that era.
Yeah.
But wasn't long lasting. You know, there was very few people came out of that with, you know, an enduring career.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, but there are those people that continually come up with new music. Those are the people that I'm interested in. You know, how does this person develop their career once they're no longer the newest, hippest thing? You know, what's really going on?
Change for the times.
It's easy to be the newest, hippest thing. I was that for a minute or three on a couple of occasions, you know, both in the rock and roll world and the scoring world.
Yeah.
That's the easy part. The hard part is what comes after.
Mm-hmm.
I could say the same thing for my father. He was the newest, hippest thing for a while in the late 50s, early 60s. And then he had to reinvent himself, which he was very, very good at. Three or four times.
Mm.
And he had a long, well, I got to tell you, this is very depressing, but I think my career is about to be longer than his. Maybe not at the same level of success, but still.
It's funny, you can have Academy Awards under your belt, but you're only as good as your next thing, you know, or your latest thing.
I think it was Maurice Jarre that used to say he hated getting Academy Awards because it meant he wasn't going to work for a year and a half, or something like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's just the nature of the industry?
No, maybe it was the nature of his arc, but that's, you know, that's what it was like for him. But no, you have to, the endurance is the interesting part.
Yeah.
And of all my friends, we all started out in the 70s together. I can think of, I guess the Eagles still tour. Jackson's still around in some form.
He's still touring, yeah.
Wendy Waldman, Carla Bonoff, who I mentioned. Still doing it, but Carla in particular has turned into a road warrior. Wendy's still around, but that's just a few.
It's just a few. You
know? I don't know what it would be like for somebody in their 20s now. Very, very different. I don't know how you get noticed.
I don't either.
I have a clue.
I don't either. There's so many ways to put out your music. But you're literally just this drop in the bucket, you know? It's got to be hard. I don't know.
Well, for us, it was easy. You go down to the Troub and hope some label reps are in the audience.
Seriously. The stories I've heard, it's like, well, wait a second. You played for a week and then now you've got a record deal. It's unbelievable to me how that was back then. Those were the days. Peter, this has been so much fun. Thank you so much for coming on and reminiscing with me and talking to me about what might be next. I'm excited to see what's next for you.
Me too.
That's how life should be. That's how life should be. All right. A big thank you to Peter Bernstein for coming on. Now, I've provided a link to his website in the show notes, so definitely take a look. I mean, not only at all of his impressive credits, but also what's on the horizon for him as well. So thanks for listening, everyone, and we'll see you at the next one.
By now, you know that sound. It's the sound of the Home Depot. But what about those sounds? Those are the sounds of an LG wash tower with ultra-large capacity serving up a powerful yet gentle clean in just 29 minutes. Making this the sound of savings on the best appliance brands. The Home Depot. How doers get more done. Get up to 25% off the LG wash tower with ultra-large capacity and reduced wash time. Pricing valid January 5th through January 25th, 2023. Gas dryer extra. U.S. only. See store or online for details.